Greetings, fellow traveler. As humanity awakens and evolves, we see change in every aspect of our lives. Let's consciously manifest our desires. I am Candace Craw Goldman, and this is New Earth Journey.
Greetings. This is episode 20 of New Earth Journey Radio. It is April 11th, 2016. And I'm really excited about the show tonight because I get to talk to an old friend. My friend's name is Andrea Linton, and she is the natural sales manager for Crown Prince Incorporated, which is a canned seafood company. And we're going to be talking today about seafood sustainability. And Andrea and I talk about this and other food and environmental issues all the time. So I invited her to come on the show and record our conversation. So welcome, Andrea.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Candace. This is a real treat.
I'm really excited, too. Some of these things I've wanted to talk to you about for a long time, and some of them we've talked about, you know, in passing together, but I'm looking forward to learning from you tonight.
Well, I'll see what I can do. I have been working in the canned seafood business for 17 years, and along the way, my natural interest in seafood, because I love seafood, has really gotten sparked by some of the issues that I saw coming up, some of the way that the industry is developing, and being in the natural food trade, in that marketplace, there's all sorts of concerns that both retailers and consumers have been bringing to our attention, or that we've been discovering that we've brought to the attention of retailers and consumers. So it's been a long learning experience. It's fascinating, but also very illustrative of the changes that are going on in how the world gets food and the pressure on wild-caught seafood, because that's what we produce, that's what we package is wild-caught seafood. But it's helped me see what's going on around the world and within the industry. So that'd be fun to talk about it. There's a huge amount to talk about and all sorts of alleyways that we can get into, but we'll see where the conversation goes.
Sure. Why don't you start by saying how long you've been working in this industry for a number of years, haven't you?
Right. 17 years now come February. This is not what I trained to work in, but I had the good fortune to start to work with Crown Prince as a consultant, and then was hired by them to be their natural sales manager. Crown Prince is a family-owned company and has been in the grocery business since 1948. And my boss, the current president of the company, developed the natural line back in 1998 because she saw, being based in Southern California, she saw the growth of stores like Mrs. Gooch's and Wild Oats and Whole Foods, and saw that there was an increasing demand for what we refer to as clean seafood. In other words, grocery, if you take a look, and it's always very important to read the label, as you and I have talked about, it's very important to read the ingredients. That means you actually have to pick up the can and turn it around, or the package, or the box, whatever it may be, and read what the ingredients are. And when you look at a lot of canned seafood in the grocery trade, particularly tuna, you see that there are chemicals that have been added to the seafood, usually things like sodium, calcium, EDTA, or pyrophosphates, or what's referred to as vegetable broth, which really has MSG in it.
Why would they add any of those things, Andrea?
Well, they have various, those chemicals have various functions. Typically, they would be to mask odor or to make the product whiter. They're in actual sense, they're bleaching agents. So they're designed to improve the look and the smell of the product. And that's often because there are, you know, this, everyone, well, almost everyone is very interested in paying as little as possible for whatever it is that they're buying. And the packers of canned seafood respond to that by using as inexpensive a process and ingredients as possible. And so this means that you have to, you know, make the product look a little bit better, and that's why the chemicals are added.
As you were speaking, I was thinking so that it doesn't smell like cat food when you open it up.
Yes. Now that, yeah, you know, and someone said this to me many years ago. In fact, I remember when I met you, when we were both living in Kansas, well, you still do, but when I was living in Kansas, that was actually where I ate my first sushi. And the same thing really applies for sushi as canned seafood. There should really be very little smell from the fish. Now, I step back from that and say the very oily fish that we can, things like herring and sardines, the oil makes them a stronger smelling fish. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you open a can of tuna or salmon or crab or clams, things like that, there really should be no fragrance almost at all. Same thing with in a sushi bar. I encourage people, if you're about to eat a piece of sushi, you hold it to your nose. If you can smell something, there's something that it's usually a mature piece of fish, and that's not what you're looking for, shall I say?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so my boss decided to develop a clean line of seafood, and so that meant taking the chemicals out and also switching the packing oil. The natural products that I sell, if they are packed in oil, are packed in olive oil. Typically in the grocery business, canned seafood, if it's packed in oil, is either packed in cottonseed or soybean oil. And of course, over the last 17 years, we have seen a lot of changes going on in oil, a lot more awareness of where oil is coming from, how it's processed, what happens to the environment when it's whatever the source of that oil is. But there, unless it's called out on the label, you can pretty much guarantee that most soybean oil and cottonseed oil these days is from a genetically modified crop.
Now that's really interesting. Now, I knew that about soybean, but I did not know that about cottonseed oil.
Mm-hmm.
But is it really from the same plant that we get cotton, as in fabric cotton?
No. The cotton that we use for fabric uses a tremendous amount of water, and it's just not where the cottonseed oil companies want to spend their money. So, you know, you caught me there. That's a darn good question, because I should be able to tell you the difference between the plants, and I don't know.
So they are different plants, though.
They are different. I mean, well, they're related, but
sure,
but you wouldn't be. It's not as if the cottonseed oil is a byproduct of the cotton production industry.
Understood.
To the best of my knowledge, but this is one of those things, Candace, I learn every day on my job, and often it's questions like that that make me go, oh, wow, I don't know.
You need to go look that one up.
Yeah, I'm going to go look that one up. But I'll tell you, one of the things that we've been, the reasons that we've been, I know even a little bit more about this, is because what is it now? Time flies. 2 years ago, we started working with the non-GMO project to verify the non-GMO status of all of our natural products. And I'm very proud to say that all of our natural products are now non-GMO verified, non-GMO project verified. And that has led to a very interesting change within the formulation of our grocery products, because yet again, the evolving of the grocery industry in the last 17 years has gotten to the point that they're very interested in the things that are that consumers have been bringing to their attention or that consumers are concerned with. So what has happened is the natural product industry has influenced the position of grocery retailers and grocery consumers. So we are now, within Crown Prince, we are now working on altering the formulation of our products on the grocery side to make sure that they can be a non-GMO project verified. And that means digging into what is the character of the oil that we're using, and if we're finding out that it's genetically modified, that we are making it clear that we need to change that oil. And I'll tell you, and so that means that I should step back and say, one of the things that I have found utterly fascinating as that has occurred as part of my job, and then and part of, for example, doing the non-GMO verification, is actually looking at how the world of ingredient supply works. And it reminds me of how there are certain forces at work that in a certain sense make sense, but in another sense are dangerous or of concern, I should say. And that is the fact that there are rather few sources these days on an international level for certain products. So when you look at a lot of canned seafood on the shelf, particularly things like oysters, clams, mussels, crab, a lot of it is coming from China. And that's because the American market, and probably many other markets, are interested in paying very little for their canned seafood. Therefore, the product usually has to come from a country where the labor costs are very low. But that also means that you are getting oil or packing material from the country in which the product is packed. And so that's one of the reasons that we're looking at probably a preponderance of genetically modified cottonseed oil and soybean oil, is because they're being produced in China for the packing industry.
You know, that this whole idea of China really, really concerns me. You know, I've heard a lot of news about the tilapia fish and then some other, news about sending. I mean, we already know that they're sending chicken over there to be processed and brought back, and they're doing more and more of that with fish. And gosh, what are your thoughts about all of that, handing our food over to be processed in that way?
Well, yeah, that was, I can still remember my boss smiling when we had gone on a trip. We regularly visit all of our packing plants all around the world, and we pack product in Morocco, Scotland, Thailand, Malaysia, Chile, Holland, and a number of other countries, and we go and visit them regularly to talk about production values, to talk about new products, to maintain a personal relationship. I mean, some of the companies that we've been working with, we've worked with them for 30 years or more, So my boss had invited me to go on a trip with her up to British Columbia to visit one of our salmon packing companies. And when I say that, I should step back, Candace, and just make it clear that pretty much these days, the canned seafood industry is co-packed, meaning hardly any canned seafood brand owns the packing plant in which their product is created. Mm-hmm. So there is a level of, you're telling someone what you want and you're having them produce this for you and then presenting it to the marketplace. That's why we go and visit these packing plants on a regular basis, so that they know that we're concerned about quality, that we have conversations about our customers and the marketplace, so that they know that we're very interested and concerned about what is being produced under our brand name. So anyway, we went up to British Columbia, went to see lovely people at the packing plant that we use there in Vancouver, and the company that we work for up there doesn't just do canned seafood, they also do frozen product. And they were telling me that it is less expensive to take British Columbian, Canadian salmon, frozen fish, send it to China to be processed into, you know, frozen, into fillets or even some prepared food, and shipped back to Canada for then distribution, than to have the product processed in Canada. And that is the problem. If the consumer was willing to pay more because for product to cover the fact that it was being manufactured in Canada or in the US in our situation, then we could actually just have the not be moving raw material around. And especially when you have oil prices as inexpensive as they are now, this is what affects decisions about this kind of activity. To me, it horrifies me. And my boss said, the look on your face when they told you that it was cheaper to do double shipping over to China and back again, it was cheaper to do it that way than to process it in Canada. She said, the look on your face was so dismayed. And I still haven't gotten over that. It's dismaying that the decision is being made to do that kind of transshipment at an environmental impact, as far as I'm concerned. It may be cheaper on the bottom line, but there are those intangibles of an environmental impact that I feel can't be ignored.
Andrea, I have to interrupt you by saying, you know, long ago, you and I, when did we even meet? 1982? Something like that?
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I remember in your first cute little apartment, I don't know why we were there, for whatever reason, I was visiting you there. And you had said something to me at the time, and I can still hear you say this, and I carry this with me, and I carry it with me into the kitchen every time I go. But I remember you saying that, and at the time, you know, we were all just starting out, and we didn't have a lot in our checking accounts. Mm-hmm. And you said something that, well, you'd made a decision that you were going to, even then, back when food was safer, so mm-hmm. much safer, right? Mm-hmm. That your decision to invest in your health with quality food was very important to you. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like, bravo, you were one of the early, you know, people in my life who made that statement. But there's more and more of us now, Andrea. Isn't there a market for people like us who are like, oh, come on, I'll pay the whatever cents more. to have it all stay, you know, clean and sustainable and all that stuff. I mean, isn't that market growing?
Oh, yes, enormously. And that's one of the reasons that we are seeing conventional brands, the conventional marketplace take on these issues that have become so viable through the natural product through the natural product marketplace. Issues about, you know, where is the food coming from? How was it processed? What chemicals were used in it? Who handled this food and how were they treated? What was their wage level? What does the company who's producing this, what do they do with their water? How do they handle their waste? Are there genetically modified ingredients in them? You know, the grocery industry has taken on and been successful with first organic products and now non-GMO verified products because people are demanding these things. And unfortunately, that demand has been stimulated by deep concern of a variety of different things. The quality of food, mistakes that have been made with food, horror stories that have been discovered about how workers are treated, or growing information about the fact that, say, for example, cacao growers or coffee growers are not paid very well given what the end brand winds up making from their labors. So there is a lot, and of course then there's just, you know, with the internet, I mean, I can still remember, my dear, when email came into our daily lives, which for me was at work back in the, like, 1999, and I can still remember thinking to myself, I don't understand this, but I can see where this is going. And now my phone hardly ever rings, and I just use email. But the same thing is this applies to the internet. Now people can get on the internet and find out information about so many things that stimulates them to be able to make better decisions and also ask questions of the companies with whom they do business. There's more, in a certain sense, at a certain level, there's more accountability because of social media. And because of companies having to have a online presence and a presence that makes sure that there is input and from consumers and that other people can see what the company has to say, you know, for better or worse, the Amazon is an amazing company in the visibility that you have to consumer comments about products. And that, I think, is, and I'm not saying that Amazon initiated that or invented that, but that the whole possibility of being able to find out information about what you're eating has just exponentially increased over the last few years. And there is a marketplace for all of and an industry to take care of all of us who are deeply concerned about our food.
Yes, well, the packing is one thing, but the waters themselves, you know, the things going on over in Japan, Fukushima and the radiation, how does that impact your industry?
Well, yes, and that whole incident, besides being such a horror and a devastation and so awful as a human to watch what happened to the communities and is still happening to the communities who were inundated, we have to remember that whole thing started off with an earthquake and then a tsunami and then the disaster at the Fukushima plant. So first off, our reaction to it was, as a company, was the deep sadness and heartbreak over the the number of lives that were destroyed and impacted in Japan. Of course, all of these coastal communities being fishermen, involving fishermen, and of course many other people. And then the impact on the Fukushima plant, which of course is still continuing to be a problem for cleanup, is what I mean. And of course the courage of the people who stayed at the plant and dealt with the plant, just amazing. But then moving on to perhaps not the more mundane, but the practicalities, was exactly where do the ocean currents around Japan carry the water? How long is an isotope shelf life? So where would fish be affected? How long would it be affected? Who is testing it? When would you begin to see this possibly show up in American waters because of cross Pacific currents? What kind of, you know, and then quite frankly, do you believe what the government is saying, or what various, you know, official bodies are saying about the level of radiation and problem coming out of that? So Candace, I mean, I can reflect about what I see reported. What the reality is, I don't know. I will say that of course, we are all connected. So when I say, and ocean currents, while they are studied, we don't necessarily know everything about them, as is true about so many things. My company doesn't harvest any fish off the Sea of Japan. But of course we know that the West Coast particularly, where I live, we began to see flotsam and jetsam from the tsunami having swept into Japan and then carried things back out to sea. I think it was about a year, maybe a bit less than a year, that flotsam started showing up on the West Coast. So that makes you think to yourself, well, if the human-made things are here that you can see, then you would have to think that there might be some radiation in the waters. Now, having said that, I have monitored both NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric, I think I'm getting that right. I'm missing something there. I've been monitoring NOAA statements, FDA statements, and also Alaska Fisheries Department statements about radiation in the waters and in fish. And according to all of those sources, there is no spike in radiation.
Andrea, it makes me want to ask you this, and what I'm saying is just, you know, what I've read in some other articles and some obviously, you know, either very passionate, or you might can say, or biased, if you want to say it in another way. Mm-hmm. But there are reports out there that there used to be stations that collected radiation data in our atmosphere, in our air. And my understanding is that a couple of things have happened. Many of those have been simply shut down. And then the second thing that I've heard is they simply changed the rate, saying, you know, the scale used to be, and I don't even know the numbers, but, you know, normal is no longer normal. They just made the scale look like the radiation coming this way from Japan now falls under normal categories. Had it been many years ago, it would not be normal. Have you heard this? What do you think about any of that?
Well, no, I haven't heard any of that. You know, My tendency would be to think that that's quite surely a possibility. We're without going into detail, because that would be subjects for many more conversations. But we're well aware that there is manipulation of information if a required or desired reaction is to be achieved. So, you know, I can just say that and leave it at that. I don't know about that. I'll say that. I'll say that my hands are pretty full with the things that I have to keep track of. And so, even though I did do a little bit of research about radiation and because of the Fukushima disaster, that was you know, at the time, and I haven't kept up on that, and I'm so I'm not I couldn't reflect about that. Well, except to say, as in a general way, that it's quite possible.
Let me just tell you this. I know, you know, a lot of people in my community, the spiritual metaphysical community, they're very concerned about the poisoning of our planet and our, you know, our human selves. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that it's starting to be pretty a common idea is to be very leery of Pacific caught, particularly tuna, because of the radiation. I mean, you know, as you're speaking about it, I'm thinking about how you talked about putting the, you know, the sushi up to your nose and sniff it. Well, nobody can sniff radiation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're kind of stuck there. But there is a persistent idea out there that, oops, maybe we shouldn't be eating anything from the Pacific Ocean, because, you know, we all live in an aquarium, really. I mean, the Earth's an aquarium. It's all going to get spread around somehow, like just like the pharmaceuticals in our tap water, right?
Well, yes. And being a gardener myself, this is, you know, it leads me back to thinking about what Michael Pollan said a number of years ago. Eat real food. Not too much, mainly vegetables. I think that the less processed your food, the less processed food you eat, the better. If you are going to eat protein sources, I would really encourage people, particularly in the first world, to eat further down the food chain. I'm thinking about seafood right now. Mm-hmm. That's why, well, we've seen a huge increase in people eating in sardines. In my time working for Crown Prince, when I first got started, the core of a canned seafood set was tuna and salmon. Mm-hmm. Now I would say that our most popular item is skinless and boneless sardines. That's what sells the most. And I think that it has it is reflection of deep concerns about what is gathering in the fish in the open oceans, because as you say, this is an enclosed system. If we put something into the atmosphere, it is typically going to stay in the atmosphere and become incorporated into the bodies of all of us, all of the living creatures on the planet, at some point or other, in some way or other, and for some length of time or other. We test our tuna, but actually the tuna that we sell, we are getting albacore from New Zealand waters, and we're getting skipjack and yellowfin tuna from the Maldives in the Indian Ocean, and we get tongal tuna from the Gulf of Thailand. So we don't sell any, we don't pack any Pacific or Northwest Coast albacore, though I eat it myself because I have an acquaintance who fishes for albacore and I buy it from them. And I would say that with the predatory fish like salmon and tuna, particularly tuna, that the smaller the fish, the better off you are, mm-hmm. if you want to eat it. Because, of course, the smaller fish are younger and have had less chance to accumulate toxins. You know, having said that, I am deeply concerned for us who are living now and the children who are being born into this world at the stuff that we are finding in human bodies, we eat and what we ingest, clothing that we've been insisting on being necessary is poisonous, as you would think that it would be. And so that there's now a stepping away from the requirement of flame-resistant clothing and bedding and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you this, that several other issues that are besides possible radiation that are of even deeper concern to me, and it's a basic thing, and I know I'm going to irritate some people in the plastics industry, but my deep concern these days is plastic in the ocean.
Yeah.
And this is something that is a complete disaster and needs a worldwide response. I'm not saying we should stop using plastic, but we should get it out of the ocean and as fast as possible, because it's contaminating the waters of our ocean and will have an effect on all of us eventually. And then the same thing also goes for ocean acidification, which is the result of climate change. That is affecting the ability of mollusks to create hard shells. And if you thought about a world in which we can't anymore harvest oysters or clams or mussels and possibly even some shellfish because they can't create shell anymore, we've got a huge issue. And that is, again, something that is going to require national, international cooperation. So I'm very appreciative of people being concerned about radiation in seafood, hoping that they take action to speak to government and governments and international bodies about their concerns and taking action about it. There are other bigger issues as well.
What I wanted to ask you about too was this whole industry of farmed fish and, mm-hmm. and the tilapia fish especially, and some of the shrimp, you know, mm-hmm. I'm like anyone else, and especially here in landlocked Kansas, you know, looking at what's available to us in the grocer's freezer or at restaurants. And, you know, my guess is there's very few restaurants, unless they're very fine restaurants, who serve wild-caught salmon. Most of it, I believe, will be the farmed Atlantic stuff. What mm-hmm. are your thoughts on some of that, some of the farmed fish?
Well, my my concern is that without solution to some of the issues we've been talking about, and let's just lump it under a general title of making the oceans incapable of supporting animal life, which would of course be a complete disaster, as well as the destruction of one of the most, we're all connected. So if we do something as disastrous as destroy the ocean's potential ability to create life, we're in big trouble. Okay, setting that aside, the strong possibility is that we will see more and more fish created in aquaculture, farmed situations for a number of reasons. Because you can control the production, you don't have to get on a boat and go out and hope you're going to be harvesting fish. Actually, that reminds me that one of my contacts in the fishery business, he said to me, "I have to remind my father that it's called fishing, not catching." Because you're not, you know, when you wild harvest fish, again, which is what Crown Prince does, when we are packing wild harvested fish, sometimes the fish do not come back. They don't return when you expect them to. That has happened to us in salmon harvests, where we pack both pink and coho salmon. Pink salmon is on a 2-year life cycle. So supposedly there's monitoring of even wild stocks. Well, of course, of wild stocks. So when pink salmon spawn leave their rivers to go back out into the open ocean for their couple of years out in the open ocean, you're supposed to be able to say, "Righto, we saw this many millions of spawn heading out of the rivers, and therefore we can expect this kind of harvest in a couple of years." Well, in my years of working in the industry, there have been a number of years, 3 that I can remember, where the projected anticipated return of pink salmon to their home rivers, spawning rivers, did not occur. So this has a huge impact. So to get to your point, I believe that we are going to see more farming, fish farming, aquaculture happening because it can be controlled. What do I think about that? I think that the efforts in the past for things like farm-raised salmon, I'm going to speak to that because salmon goes in a can as well as being sold fresh. The other fish that is being farm-raised, things like tilapia, barramundi, catfish, they are not canned. So I can't speak to them. Salmon being farm-raised has had a bad reputation, deservedly so, because the industry has not done well in the past managing the waste that comes from these fish farms, from the salmon farms. Mm-hmm. There has also been issues about what are the fish fed, and the fact that, of course, when you are confining a creature with a lot of other members of its own kind, you run into issues of disease, and so these creatures are now being fed antibiotics. So there are now there's recognition of the fact that you have these sort of problems in aquaculture, and that they cannot, you know, people have complained, there's obviously problems, there have become to be stricter rules because of consumer complaints and governmental observation, and so there's now a developing industry of creating better methods, better enclosures that, for example, capture the fecal matter and capture the discarded or uneaten food to protect the environment from these fish farms. To me, of course, what we're getting into then is the matter of the feed. What are you feeding these creatures? Mm-hmm. Salmon the analogy is a cattle feedlot. What salmon farms or fish, fish being raised in the open ocean in open pens, in essence, it's a cattle feedlot, but in the water. Mm-hmm. So the inherent problems that you have in cattle feedlots are what you're going to have in ocean feedlots, shall we say. And so then again, now you are.
You are one busy lady.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Someone keeps on trying to call me, and I'm having to tell them I'm not here. What is happening when you feed fish is that salmon are carnivorous by nature. Therefore, when you feed them, you are going to have to feed them some sort of protein. And that protein in the past has come from other fish. But it is one of those inefficient transferences of protein that you need something like 3 pounds of protein in order to create a pound of fish, of salmon protein. So what are people doing? They were going out and harvesting things like anchovies or sardines, perfectly good edible fish for humans, and grinding it up and turning it into fish meal for salmon. Because that's expensive, and because there's an increasing demand and viability for sardines and anchovies to be sold to be used for something else that can make more money than fish meal, a lot of fish meal companies are now turning to soy.
Oh no!
As the protein source.
Oh no!
Oh yes. which, of course, is going to be genetically modified. So we're going to be going through a process, as with so many other industries, evolutions of whatever it may be. We're going to be going through a process to getting people who are going to be doing aquaculture to do it correctly, in a sensible, environmentally conscious, sustainable way. I think that we are going to, as I said, we're going to see more of it because it will allow for control of the product.
But you're really saying it can be done well. I mean, saying farmed fish,
yes,
doesn't automatically give it a bad name. It's just the way it used to be done.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. You can do it properly. It will be more expensive.
As it should be.
Well, as it should be. And, you know, and that leads me to say that I think it's very important for people, and here, this is my hobby horse, it's very important for people to honor the fact that food costs a lot of money to make correctly. Mm-hmm. The people who are producing it should be being paid an adequate amount of money for what is very hard work, very necessary work. And you should be paying for food that is of quality. And so, my personal feeling is, and apparently, bless you for remembering that from years ago, I think that people should be willing to pay for quality, recognizing that what you put in your body is going to create a certain level of health based on the quality of what you put in your body. So if you eat garbage, you're going to wind up in pretty poor health.
You know what's really interesting? You and I have parents in their late 80s and 90s now. And I think often about this. You know, there certainly were hard times. They were born in the 20s and 30s. My dad, I guess, is the youngest that we're talking about here, and he was born in 1930. There were definitely hard times about food, but there weren't the massive pesticides, no GMOs or whatever. So these people developed their human bodies, their systems, their organs, their cells, their bones, on food that was, you know, not tainted like this. And even you and I, as children, you know, we started out our earlier years pretty good, and then somewhere in our youth is when all this stuff started exploding, and being a different kind of way, you know, food like items instead of food, and the consequences of this, you know, have got to be extraordinary, and we really need to think about this. Mm-hmm. There are people who are saying, "Oh, I would buy organic, except for it's so expensive," and I keep thinking, if everyone tomorrow only bought organic, conventional food would vaporize, mm-hmm. and organic food costs would go down. Period. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting that your reflections about our parents, because my dad told me stories. My dad grew up in Hartlepool, the east coast of England, northeast coast of England. It's a fishing town. And he lived there until he was 12. So he was born in 25 and lived there until 1937. So during the years of what was almost a worldwide depression, and his dad worked connected to the fisheries. He wasn't a fisherman, but he repaired nets and did carpentry work. And my granddad had many friends who would give them fish. So my dad and my grandmom, my grandmother apparently got so tired of fish that she would say, oh, you know, not more halibut or not more cod or whatever it might have been. And I said to my dad, the fish that you ate, you can't even get anymore.
Right.
And they had it in abundance. So I hear what you're saying. I'll tell you, my reflection is what happened to food, particularly in the Western world, was the Second World War, mm-hmm. when it was necessary from a particular point of view to create a bunch of food that could be shipped over with troops so that they had a guaranteed supply of food. That led to the processing of food to an accelerated degree, and that became what was the standard. I mean, during the 50s, so much of what people were encouraged to eat was packaged food, and this was all an explosion out of the Second World War's production of shelf-stable food. Mm-hmm. That, I think, in essence, the technology that was used, and you know, war and its impact is another entire month worth of discussions. But in this case, I think that to put our finger on it, the mass production of shelf-stable food for the war effort is something that we have only slowly started to from which we've only started to recover.
You know, Andrea, I think this might be a really great time to sort of wrap it up here, because this has been so amazing to talk with you. I hope you come back and talk to me more about some of these issues, because we could go on and on. I've learned so much today about so many things, and we've only just barely scratched the surface on many of these issues, and I think we have a lot to discuss. Would you return to talk more in the future?
Well, you know, I would be delighted, absolutely delighted.
And there's so many things we could talk about. I mean, this is just one little thing we could talk about, but this has been delightful. Well, I want to tell the audience, if they have any questions at all that they might want to ask Andrea directly about what she knows about natural products and canning seafood industry, you can find her at andrea@crownprince.com. That's andrea@crownprince.com. I'll put that down on the link and underneath the show as well. So, Andrea, you live up in beautiful Washington State. How's the weather today? What's on your table for the rest of your day?
Well, there's a bit of fog hanging over the water, which is quite all right. It's supposed to get a bit of rain today, which is grand, because my mom and I put in potatoes yesterday and onions and lettuce seed, so we need the rain. That's a nice gift of water. But I have to work today, but I get to look out on my garden. So
that's wonderful. Well, we're out of time, Andrea. Thank you again for joining me, and I want to thank everyone who's been listening this evening as well, or sometime in the future on the archives. So remember to join me next time on another New Earth Journey show. And until then, remember that all shall be well. Good night.